7BR Part Heard.
Hello, and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Rhys Palmer, Chambers Paralegal. This week, we're moving away from our regular podcast format to bring you a webinar hosted by Andrew Wheeler QC from 7BR in conjunction with Clifford Chance and the Law Commission to discuss the topic of DPAs.
Well, good afternoon and a very warm welcome to this webinar relating to deferred prosecution agreements, DPAs, hosted by 7BR Chambers in conjunction with Clifford Chance and the Law Commission. I'm Andrew Wheeler QC. I'm head of the financial crime team here at 7BR Chambers. I'll be chairing this afternoon's discussions. Tonight we have a distinguished panel of four speakers who I'll introduce in a little more detail just before they speak. But for now, briefly, Christopher David from Clifford Chance, Michael Lyons from Clifford Chance, Alex Jane from the UK's Serious Fraud Office, and Alex Young here from 7BR Chambers. Each of our panelists will speak for a few minutes about a different subject matter relating to DPAs, and we will then take questions from the floor. Before we reach that part of the evening, however, can I introduce you to two representatives of the Law Commission directly involved in the current consultation? Firstly, Law Commissioner Professor Sarah Green, and secondly, Law Commission lawyer David Allen. So Sarah, if I may hand over to you for a moment to introduce from the Law Commission's perspective.
Yeah, thank you very much, Andrew, and good afternoon, everybody. And on behalf of the Law Commission, thank you to everybody for coming, to our panellists and to our hosts, Clifford Chance and Seven Bedford Row. So by way of a brief introduction for those who've not attended one of these events before, last year we were asked by five government departments, the Ministry of Justice, HMT, the Home Office, the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, and the Attorney General's Office to provide a paper on options to reform the law of corporate criminal liability. And we intend to publish that options paper at the end of this year. Our terms of reference for the project include examining whether the common law identification doctrine is satisfactory and looking at other ways in which criminal liability could be imposed on non-natural persons, such as a new corporate offence of failing to prevent certain crimes. We're also obviously reviewing deferred prosecution agreements and the relationship between the criminal law and the civil law in this area. We must also consider the impact of potential law reform on corporations, for example, to avoid placing a disproportionate and costly compliance burden on law-abiding businesses. So to this end, the project is slightly unusual in that it's a joint project, doesn't usually happen in the Law Commission. So as Andrew said, I'm Sarah Green and I'm the Commissioner for Commercial and Common Law. And we also have the Criminal Law Commissioner here today, Professor Penny Lewis, because this is a joint project between the Criminal Law team and the Commercial and Common Law team. So this consultation is to inform that options paper, and it goes on from June to August of this year. We have published a discussion paper, the link to which should now be, or very soon will be, in the chat box. That discussion paper includes 13 broad questions, and they're also found on our online consultation tool on the Citizen Space website. That's also a link that should appear very soon. And we would encourage you all to go to that website. You just have to enter some brief details and tell us what you think in response to some or all of the questions. We work in a highly consultative way, and so your responses are incredibly important to us. And those answers will form the evidence that we use in our report. So today is the fifth of seven consultation events, and we're going to be focusing on DPAs. The next one is next Wednesday, the 14th of July. That's with Evershed Sutherland, and that's looking at wider corporate criminal liability and should that be a matter for the civil courts. So if you'd like to attend any of the other events, then please do register your interest at our website. And again, that's a link that should appear fairly soon if it isn't there already. Also, if you want to contact us directly, we're always happy to hear from people in by any means, really. So you can do it via Twitter at law_commission or by email at criminal@lawcommission.gov.uk. Andrew's already said we have a very distinguished panel today, and I am very much looking forward to hearing the discussion. But for now, I will hand you over to David Allen, who's masterminded really this whole series of events, and we're very grateful to him for that. And he's going to say a few words on the substance of the discussion paper. David.
Well, thank you, Sarah. That's very kind. Well, overall, DPAs are very popular, and the 9 DPAs secured so far by the SFO undoubtedly constitute big wins for their efforts and for the public purse more generally. Now, at the Law Commission, as law reformers, naturally, we are more inclined to look for issues with the current law and how it might be reformed. And so that's what I'm going to focus on in my brief remarks. Now, first of all, one possibility is a reform to permit a discrete ruling by a judge on a contentious issue during negotiations with DPA. Now, this was something raised by a stakeholder with us, and what they described was a situation where the parties wanted a DPA but couldn't agree on a particular point or certain points. Should a judge be permitted to give some kind of ruling on that point? Now, at present, there doesn't appear to be anything in Schedule 17 of the 2013 Act that prevents a judge from expressing such a without prejudice view, but perhaps there could be some benefit from something more explicit and something formalised in the legislation along these lines. Well, a second issue might be, is there a danger of improper pressure being applied to companies to enter into DPAs? Now, you might scoff at this idea, but one of the points that's been made to us is that the very attractiveness of DPAs to companies compared to a criminal conviction might lead companies to enter into DPAs for alleged wrongdoing for which they have a potentially good answer. What is suggested to us is that companies may be so afraid of reputational harm caused by being seen to contest criminal proceedings that they may be inclined to enter into DPAs regardless of the merits. Well, does that matter? Prosecutors say that they would not enter into a DPA unless there was sufficient evidence against a defendant. However, a legal system whereby any subject of proceedings, be they a natural or legal person, does not feel reasonably free to contest the case against them is perhaps problematic. Well, does this sound far-fetched? Well, perhaps, but the preponderance of cases where individuals have been acquitted after their employer has entered into a DPA, albeit on a very small sample size, perhaps gives some weight to the suggestion that those employers are entering into DPAs in cases where they might have had a legitimate argument to make. Another issue that's been raised is, do DPAs prejudice the chances of convicting individuals? And this was a point raised at our first webinar. And the point is that the more that we in civil discourse focus on the idea of crime being something that's committed by companies, and at the same time we have a system whereby companies but not individuals can avoid a conviction by an arrangement including the exchange of a large amount of money, are we creating a situation whereby the chances of convicting those individuals in later trials are lessened because their advocates can make the point to a jury? And as we all know, not every point made to a jury is overburdened with merit, that the corporation is at fault here, but in a way not open to my individual client, they've been able to buy their way out of a trial. Another potential problem with DPAs may be that prosecutors and potentially the courts have strong incentives to agree them. Now, a concern might be that prosecutors and possibly courts are too incentivized to enter into DPAs. What I mean by that is, if I was a prosecutor contemplating a trial of individuals for fraud that might potentially last months or, certainly weeks, the last thing I would want would be, on top of all the issues concerning the fraud, having to broach with a jury issues concerning the identification principle or whether a company's procedures were adequate in the context of guidelines, industry practice, and no doubt experts called on each side. So if I was a prosecutor, I'd feel I would have a very strong incentive to enter into a DPA. Similarly, a court, perhaps considering long trial waiting lists, might feel a strong incentive not to interfere with a preliminary agreement reached by the parties that would resolve the need for a trial or potentially the risk of multiple trials if there are hung juries. So a concern might be that there's a temptation on prosecutors and courts to gradually widen the circumstances in which a DPA might be available to a corporation, and so lessen the deterrent effect of potential criminal convictions upon corporations. And that brings me really to the anomalous nature of DPAs. because they represent an opportunity for companies, but not individuals, to enter into such an agreement is an anomaly. You can have cautions against individuals, but they tend to be used for first offenders for less serious crimes. Now, one rationale for offering DPAs to corporations but not individuals for serious crimes is that crimes allegedly committed by corporations are somehow less serious or not really crimes. But if that is the case, if that is the view of people, and given the other potential issues that I've touched on, the pressure on companies, the pressure on prosecutors and courts, the potential risks to criminal trials of individuals, all arise out of the circumstances of a DPA as being part of the criminal justice system, then does the existence and the success of DPAs mean there is an argument for moving from a deferred prosecution system to a non-prosecution system, i.e. where these agreements and the litigation in the absence of an agreement is dealt with in the civil courts? Thank you. Back to you, Andrew.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Sarah, and thank you, David. Can I now move to the first of our panelists, if I may, Christopher David. Christopher, thank you. Christopher has recently joined Clifford Chance as Director of White Collar Crime. He represents both companies and individuals in a broad range of criminal matters, including allegations of fraud, bribery and corruption, insider dealing, tax evasion and money laundering. And Christopher's going to very kindly say a few words in general outline terms about DPAs. Thank you, Christopher.
Each of the Law Commission's recent consultation events have been extremely interesting, and many have eloquently discussed DPAs in some detail. And I'm therefore keen today not to go over ground that has already been well covered. But I would, though, like to take a step back and look at DPAs in terms of what I think is one of the fundamental purposes of the DPA regime. Like all of the speakers today, I'm hoping that my comments can be used as a jump-off point for further discussion later in the session. So what were the overarching purposes of the DPA regime, apart from the firmly denied additional revenue stream for the government? When considering this question, I think it's helpful to go back to the original government proposals in 2012 and 2013, which ultimately led to the Crime and Courts Act. The Solicitor General at the time summarised what the government was proposing by saying, "I'm confident that DPAs will enable prosecutors to take appropriate action against commercial organisations involved in economic crime, and that they will work well alongside existing methods. DPAs will not be a substitute for investigations or prosecutions, but an additional weapon in the prosecutor's armoury, which will provide them with greater flexibility to pursue an alternative outcome in appropriate cases." It is this last part which I want to focus on, flexibility for prosecutors and corporates, which in my view is exactly what the enforcement of corporate crime requires. It's easy to forget before the arrival of DPAs, we were faced with trying to shoehorn corporate settlements into unsuitable forms, such as plea agreements for books and records offences and civil recovery orders. All of us practicing in this area of law understand the need for flexibility. The application of the criminal law is often seen as a blunt tool. But in this particular area, pragmatism by a prosecutor and a defendant company is an extremely useful way of holding a company to account and maintaining public confidence, which also providing the company with some certainty and an element of control in what undoubtedly is a challenging period for any company. Too much flexibility would obviously be unwanted, but I don't think that is the case with the DPAs which have been agreed so far. Firstly, there is no question that entering into a DPA it has significant consequences for the company. Some of the fines so far have been greater than anything we've ever seen in the criminal courts prior to the introduction of DPAs. And the efforts most companies have gone to in terms of remediation linked to a DPA have been equally significant. From the prosecution side, the discussion often focuses on the judicial oversight of DPAs, but the role of the SFO as a gatekeeper should also be recognised. It is absolutely clear that the SFO has taken its role extremely seriously and have carefully applied the evidential test to each DPA, bearing in mind that this test is the 51% chance of conviction test, as opposed to the burden of proof for a jury. With that in mind, one area of criticism which has been discussed at length recently is the lack of subsequent successful prosecution of individuals following the entering into of a DPA. To my mind, this is a distraction. I think that they should be viewed as two separate processes. As we all know, there are plenty of reasons why a corporate may enter into a DPA, which subsequently does not lead to the successful prosecution of individuals. As a side point, I don't believe this is a particularly new issue. There are examples of historic cases pre-DPAs where the corporate pleaded guilty and the basis of plea named senior individuals who were not charged and who strongly denied the allegations. It has recently been argued that the SFO's failure to successfully prosecute individuals, especially those that would be considered the controlling mind for the purposes of the criminal trial, suggests that companies should avoid a DPA and take the matter to trial. Whilst the defence lawyer in me would love more companies to go to trial, it is simply not a realistic option for most corporates. I know Michael will discuss the corporate view of DPAs later, but I consider a DPA to be similar to a pragmatic plea, i.e. the evidence may not be a slam dunk, but the defendant, the company, is not prepared to take the risk of a criminal trial. It is perhaps not intellectually perfect, and in theory, the law should not have these grey areas. But the fact is that, as I suggested earlier, the approach to criminal cases of this nature requires some flexibility, which brings me full circle to where I started. The enforcement of corporate crime requires pragmatism. In my view, DPAs provide this, and to tinker with the underlying law at this relatively young stage of its life seems premature and unnecessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christopher. Now, looking at matters from the prosecutor's point of view, may I introduce you to Alex Jane of the UK Serious Fraud Office. Alex, you are a case controller at the UK Serious Fraud Office. You have particular experience working on global bribery investigations and also on deferred prosecution agreements. Can you give us DPAs from the prosecutor's perspective?
Thank you, Andrew. And thank you also to Seven Bedford Row and Clifford Chance for the invitation to this really interesting discussion. From the prosecutor's perspective, we are seeing DPAs delivering some of the aims in the consultation that Christopher spoke about. In particular, there's accountability in terms of the admission of conduct in the statement of facts and the public airing of it in the final hearing. The usual approach to penalty as well has been to strip the profits of wrongdoing from the company and to also penalise the company for what it has done. Christopher mentioned the size of these fines and the fact also that they're dwarfing some of the fines prior to DPAs. And to provide some additional context in that, on the Airbus case, the judge stated that the fine was more than double the total of fines paid in respect of all criminal conduct in England and Wales in 2018. Some DPAs have also provided reparation for victims in the form of compensation, which is carefully considered in every DPA case and has been provided in the Standard Bank case and also very recently in the Amick Foster Wheeler case. Rehabilitation is an important aspect as well. It's a relevant quid pro quo of DPAs that where a company has sought to take responsibility for conduct and to cooperate with the SFO, the punitive effect should not be so damaging as to put the company out of business. And DPAs to date have sought to rehabilitate the company through implementing change and also with independent oversight where necessary. Monitors are also an option in future DPA cases. The measures put in place have offered a public precedent and play their part in positively driving compliance improvements. DPAs avoid the uncertainty and cost of criminal trials for the SFO, for companies and for court staff, freeing up all of those to address other pressing work. Prior to DPAs, there were relatively limited prosecutions of companies and smaller fines. Since they were introduced, the SFO has reached 10 DPAs and obtained around 1.6 billion of penalties. I believe it's unlikely that similar results would have been achieved through convictions at trial. DPAs are delivering in bringing more cases to justice more efficiently. Cooperation is a key consideration as well, and in particular where conduct is disclosed to us, which we would not otherwise know about. This has been a game changer for us in developing our investigations and developing a fuller intelligence picture about all the companies involved in relevant criminality. It also empowers our relationships with foreign partners so we can understand the case earlier and work out where the conduct should be investigated and resolved. So I just wanted to touch on how DPAs fit in with the wider, with the sort of wider work as well in relation to corporate liability that the Law Commission is doing. So the ability to enter DPAs is closely linked to underlying corporate liability laws. They need to have a basis in legal principle through the evidential test consideration. And in fraud cases, currently companies may be less incentivized to cooperate due to the control of minds and will requirement. And it's no coincidence that 7 out of the 10 DPAs to date have involved Section 7 of the Bribery Act. Having said that, I mean, fraud is the most prevalent, is more prevalent, or is understood to be more prevalent than bribery. So if a offence with a wider range of conduct was introduced, that would in turn support the DPA regime and the benefits that it brings. I wanted to touch on one challenge that was mentioned by David at the start as well, in the trials of individuals, there may be a perception in juries that the company has somehow got away with it by entering a DPA. I don't believe that it's logically correct for that view to be taken because of the accountability that a DPA produces. And obviously, as we're not privy to deliberations of a jury, it's difficult to know if this is a real risk. Having said that, I think it should be emphasised to juries the accountability point, as well as the reasons why DPAs are not currently available for individuals. There was one final point I wanted to touch on as well, which David also mentioned at the start, was whether companies will enter DPAs given some of the individual acquittals that have taken place recently, or will be more incentivized to take their chances at trial. Christopher mentioned the pragmatism and the commercial certainty that DPAs offer. And I certainly agree with that. And I also agree with the point that it's the importance of prosecutor rigorously applying the evidential test and public interest test to ensure that they stand up to scrutiny. And I also agree with Christopher on the point about not conflating the DPA process and individual prosecutions. Just because there is evidence against a corporate, it does not necessarily follow that there will be against an individual. And obviously there's a lower evidential test for a DPA and the higher standard for individuals. Thank you, Andrew. That was what I wanted to say on DPAs.
Thank you very much indeed, Alex, looking at it from the prosecutor's perspective. I think we can now look at DPAs from the corporate perspective. Can I introduce you to Michael Lyons from Clifford Chance, partner at Clifford Chance, who specialises in financial crime enforcement and investigations. He's currently working on the defence of a large corporate, which is the subject of an ongoing criminal prosecution. So, Michael, from the corporate's point of view, thank you.
Thanks very much, Andrew. As you say, I'm going to make a few points. I'll try and be brief. I'll make a few points which reflect some conversations that we've had with a number of corporate clients of ours on these very issues. I should add at the beginning, these are corporate clients who have strong compliance records, who are subject to sort of stringent governance codes and sometimes regulation as well. They're not, as it has been put, the kind of organisations which, simply because they are large, could be termed as having a culture that might be said to be organised irresponsibility. That's a phrase which is not accepted by corporate organisations who strive to achieve good governance and good compliance frameworks within them. They are organisations who accept that in the realms particularly of tax evasion and bribery overseas in particular, that there is a clear public imperative and need to have a strong incentive to prevent activities of that nature being undertaken in their names. Now, what's under discussion at present in the subtext of today's discussion about DPAs is a possible expansion of those failure to prevent offences, which are fundamentally and necessarily a very different sort of offence to the offences which require any kind of evidence of fault on the part of the defendant. They are akin to the kind of strict liability offences that arise in the eyes of many corporates. And that's because once there is evidence of the underlying bribe that has taken place, for example, the corporate will inevitably face an uphill battle, a battle probably of Everest-like proportions, to establish that their procedures to prevent that bribe were adequate. After all, if they were adequate, how did the bribe take place in the first place? The perception is one misstep, one failure, once the SFO or the other prosecutors are looking at you, and the defence risks collapsing, and the result is the prospect of a real conviction. But because these are offences are quasi-regulatory offences, the consequences are, and on the whole, have tended to be different as well. Therefore, rather than prosecute them, because most of these firms tend to be well-meaning, well-intentioned firms that want to cooperate with the authorities, they get offered a DPA. And as has been said already by Chris and others, a DPA is a pragmatic solution. It resolves the problem that the directing mind and will cannot be found for the underlying offence. And as the SFO said, it results in a very large revenue stream for the Treasury. But perhaps one might say, as demonstrated by the very fact that the director of the SFO had to write in a column in the Times to explain what a DPA is, they don't quite capture the public imagination in the same way, and nor should they. A DPA is not a conviction, and for these kind of offences, one might say, nor should it be. Perhaps except in the most egregious cases, these offences, failure to prevent, do not involve wrongdoing in the way ordinarily understood. Is it right, therefore, that a corporate under investigation for such offences should be put through the burden of a criminal trial for a failure to prevent offence? By the time the offending is investigated, often it's many years later, the staff have often moved on, so have many of the shareholders. There is a penalty of sorts imposed, but it's imposed on a very different organisation than the one that perhaps did the underlying offending. The Law Commission itself has noted in its guidance that the Sentencing Council guidelines for corporate offences refer to the fact that when imposing a fine on a corporate, the fine must be sufficiently substantial to have a real economic impact which will bring home to both management and shareholders the need to comply with the law. There is, though, an issue, surely, with these sorts of offences, particularly if there's a condition of the DPA that management involved have moved on and so on. But given the staff are different, the shareholders are different, what kind of incentive is trying to be achieved through these kind of fines for these kind of offences? The problem which the Law Commission is rightly seeking to grapple with is that there is a difficulty in convicting corporates because you cannot attach fault to the legal entity. If the solution proposed is to create a whole new range of offences with a lesser degree of culpability for which fault is not a constituent element, then you are not fixing that problem with that solution. It may be that a laudable side effect is to improve corporate culture, but it doesn't truly solve the problem, which is that where DPAs are offered, and it's submitted that for offences of this nature they really ought to be offered, the result is not a criminal conviction, because it is not a criminal offence in the truest sense which is being committed. In other words, by expanding corporate criminal liability in this way, the problem is not being solved, but bypassed with a range of new lesser offences for which culpability is not relevant and which, there, for all the reasons that have already been discussed, a DPA should rightly be offered. Andrew, that was all I wanted to say. I said I'd try and keep it brief. Let me pass it back to you and hand the floor to others.
Thank you very much indeed, Michael. Now I think we can ask Alex Young to have a look at other sentencing options for corporates. Alex is a member of the financial crime team here at 7BR Chambers. He acts in criminal and regulatory investigations relating to misconduct by corporations and by senior management, both here in the UK and in various different offshore jurisdictions. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks very much, Andrew. As Andrew said, I've been asked just to say a few words about prosecution as an alternative to the DPA, and in particular to contrast the package of measures that might be available under a DPA with the sentencing options in the Crown Court should a case result in prosecution. And of course, there may be a number of cases where a DPA simply isn't available as a matter of law because the offence is not one that's specified, or it may be a case where the company's offence is so serious that applying the code and the guidance that a prosecution is in the public interest and a DPA, even if theoretically available, is simply not the desired option. And the Law Commission's research suggests that in 2020 alone, there were over 5,000 prosecutions of various corporations for various different offences in the courts in England and Wales. So despite that large number, certainly compared to the number of DPAs that we can still just about count on our fingertips, It is surprising to consider that the Crown Court's sentencing powers for dealing with corporations are woefully, in my view, inadequate compared to the measures that would have been available as part of a negotiated and approved DPA. And so what I'd like to do is just spend a minute or two talking about the current powers and also looking at some other possibilities for enhancing those powers. The main power, as the Law Commission has identified in its paper, is the power to fine and also to pay the costs of a prosecution. But of course, that can already be achieved through a financial penalty agreed under a DPA. There is no power in the Crown Court to suspend a fine, either in whole or in part. And given that suspended sentences are an important tool in the armoury of measures available when sentencing individuals, it's difficult, in my view, to identify a reason in principle why one wouldn't want the option of suspending fines in whole or in part in a given case in a sentence in the Crown Court of a corporation. There is similarly no general provision in the Crown Court for what we might call corporate probation or some form of corporate post-sentence supervision. There are a couple of specific powers under specific acts that I'll come back to in a moment, but there is no general power. And again, just to contrast it with the position so far as sentencing individuals is concerned, clearly post-sentence supervision is a widely used and indeed vitally important part of sentencing in individual cases. And again, it's difficult to identify a principal reason why the same should not at least be a possibility, an option available to the court when dealing with a corporate. Of course, practical questions would then have to be considered of who will supervise the corporate. Will it be a regulator, for example, if it's a regulated corporation? There is a further power which does exist under the current Sentencing Act and indeed did under the previous legislation to defer a sentence in the Crown Court for up to 6 months on conditions. And that power isn't one that is referred to in the Law Commission's paper, and I'd be interested for their views on whether they think it might be a power that could be expanded for more use against corporations. But as it stands, it could be used against corporations, and indeed my research has identified some examples where it has been. And again, it might be an appropriate power to use. In other words, you don't pass the sentence straight away. You give the company X amount of months to get its affairs in order, and you then pass sentence once you're satisfied that it has done so. There are then, as I've indicated, some specific statutory powers to make what are called remedial orders, and in particular under the Corporate Manslaughter Act of 2007 and the Health and Safety in Work Act of 1974. The court has the power, when it passes sentence for offences under those acts, to require the corporation to put right matters that are relatable to the offence of which it has been committed. But again, in substance, you might think that is something that could already be achieved through a package of supervision put in place under a DPA. The other major power that exists currently in the Crown Court is the Serious Crime Prevention Order. And here, again, this is something that will achieve nothing, in my view, that couldn't be achieved under a DPA. And indeed, as Lord Justice Edis pointed out last Thursday when approving the latest DPA in the Amec Foster Wheeler case, The DPA in that case included a number of undertakings given by the group parent company of the defendant company, and Lord Justice Edis rightly observed that those undertakings as part of the DPA would not have been available to the court to impose, whether through a serious crime prevention order or any other sentence in the Crown Court, had there been a prosecution. And finally, the other major tool in the Crown Court's arsenal is confiscation under the Proceeds of Crime Act. But again, there is nothing that can achieve that could not be achieved through an agreed settlement under a DPA to pay back any profits gained as a result of the criminal activity in question. And finally, just having identified the powers and suggested that they really don't take matters very much further than DPAs, it's also worth bearing in mind there is no statutory principle of sentencing for corporations. There is a specific statutory definition of the purposes of sentencing for both adults and youths. There is not for corporations, and that certainly would be an area where further statutory intervention would be welcome. It would certainly bring things into line with the treatment of individuals. And if the sentencing powers are to be increased, it would give sentencing judges certainly more of a steer as to how they should exercise those powers. So, Andrew, that's a very quick run through of the role of the Crown Court and its role compared with DPAs.
Thank you very much indeed, Alex. I wonder if we could have all four panellists on screen, because there are some questions that have arisen, a number of them arising, it seems, from what David mentioned earlier. And the first one is this, and Christopher, I wonder if I can ask this of you. And does emphasis on corporate crime harm the prospect of convicting individuals?
Shortly, no. I think all of us that are used to practicing in the criminal courts recognise how sensible juries are. And I think juries are more than capable of understanding the role of a DPA and why they should apply themselves to the evidence in relation to the individuals that are before them. I think, as I said, it's a distraction. The failure to successfully prosecute individuals so far has been a distraction. I think almost every case that has been to court and has either collapsed at half time or, well, particularly those ones, or as a result of a jury verdict, there's specific issues with those cases that are fact specific to the case. I don't need to necessarily go into each of those cases, but you know, there was misunderstanding by the prosecution in terms of the evidence, use of experts, and then for the ones that never made it to court, frankly, you know, whilst I'm sure the individuals were delighted, some slightly mysterious application of the Code for Crown Prosecutors. So I don't think I just don't think it's an issue. I think you know, if this, again, for those of us that you know are in court, cases are successfully prosecuted based on the evidence, and you often hear, well, certainly a former director was very keen on pointing out that the evidence always stops short of the senior individuals in a company, but the evidence is simply not there, and therefore you can't prosecute individuals. So yeah, no, would be my answer to that question. But with a long-winded,
a systematic failure.
Yeah,
thank you. Alex Jane, I wonder if I could ask you this, and again, it was something David mentioned earlier. Is there or should there be power for the court to assist the parties in resolving issues, for example, which are not agreed?
I think, I mean, one of the main reasons for a DPA is cooperation. And generally in the DPAs that I've worked on, cooperation has meant that you, by the time you get to the court, you should have resolved all issues, essentially, for the judge, and be able to present that. Otherwise, there are potential question marks over whether a DPA is really appropriate. I'd be very interested to know the types of issue that potentially would need sort of judicial oversight at that point. And I personally don't see the harm in having that provision and that flexibility within the system in case such a situation did arise. But I'd be very interested in the sort of potential examples there.
Yes. I suppose it would arise where the parties had sort of got a long way down the line and were agreed pretty much about most issues. and there may just be one or two sort of sticking points, to use the colloquialism, it might, do you think, be a reasonable avenue then for the parties to come to the court and just set out those issues, for the court to either give some guidance or make a ruling, or without effectively undermining the cooperative nature of the negotiations between the parties?
Andrew, you suggest it's a little bit like the focus resolution agreement process in the financial regulatory services industry, where you can still benefit from the discount if you're a regulated firm, for an early settlement. If you disagree on some aspects but not all aspects, you can get those aspects resolved by the RDC. It's so some sort of a similar form that doesn't require you to have to have agreed everything up front.
Yeah, I think, Michael, do you think that would be helpful to read that over into the DPA jurisdiction?
It may be an issue. I'll let Alex speak, because I apologise I did interrupt. But, you know, it seems to me that that's a similar construct that, you know, might have some value in this concept, in this situation, if in fact those issues are arising, where a corporate feels that there's one particular issue where the prosecutor is not willing to bend and not willing to listen to it, and they have no choice either to throw in the can and go to trial on the whole lot, or agree. It seems to me that there might be appropriate use of a mechanism to resolve those kind of issues.
Yeah, I mean, Alex, do you think that would bring greater flexibility to the system, just in the event of the odd DPA here and there, where there may be some issues that need properly resolving by the court?
Yes, I think, I mean, it certainly would depend on the issue, but I think within the private hearing mechanism as well, where it's there's that layer of confidentiality if things go wrong, which protects the company, I think there would be a sort of safe forum to talk through those issues, assuming there's a sufficient judicial resource to deal with that.
Yeah, thank you. Michael, I wonder if I could ask you this, if I may, and listening to what's been said today, does the system as it currently stands and as it's currently operated, do you think it causes any imbalance of power between the parties?
Well, I think a lot's been said on this already, actually, and I agree with what's been said on this presentation on this subject, which is that from a corporate's perspective, if you're presented with an investigation and the prospect of a DPA, there's a lot to weigh in before you can decide what to do. The risk is the prospect of a criminal trial, which in the eyes of many corporates is a punishment in and of itself. It's timely, it's costly, it has huge reputational adverse impacts for a firm who goes through a criminal prosecution. Most of the time, you know, we see corporates at that early stage weighing up what are the reputational impacts of all of these different options. And that's often, you know, except where they've got concerns about the existential impact of a fine, that's the predominant concern, is what impact will this have on our reputation, on our goodwill, on our customer base if we fight. And if you're a corporate and you're presented with a DPA, it's an easier way of resolving the issue and making it go away quickly. And that's often the concern. And so if you think of that sort of background, in a sense, maybe there's nothing that can be done about it, because it's just a natural feature of how these things work. But if you, in that context, there is an imbalance, because the corporate is heavily incentivized to agree, because the failure of not doing so can be so significant and outweigh you know any other consideration.
Yeah, can you think of any way that imbalance could be resolved?
Well, I mean, I suppose listening to what David said at the beginning, there is a possibility that for some offences, and you heard in my remarks that the failure to prevent offences are naturally of a different kind to the other kind of offences where corporates get prosecuted. You know, there may be other outcomes other than prosecutions at all which could be considered. But in the current environment, it's difficult to see what could be done when a corporate is faced with the prospect of a DPA, you know, how it could readdress that balance. I'd be welcoming the thoughts of any other panelists, or in fact the audience, on their views on that. I think unfortunately it's one of those things where it just creates a natural difficulty.
Thank you. Alex Young, could I ask you this, if I may? Should DPAs be extended to individuals as they are, for example, in the in the US? Would there be any benefit in that?
Well, I think as I think it might have been Michael pointed out, at the moment DPAs don't feature widely in the public consciousness. And I think if they were to feature more prominently, the question that the proverbial man on the Clapham bus would ask is, well, why do these things exist in the first place, rather than can I have a piece of the action but by availing myself of it? It's difficult, isn't it? Because I can see there may be some situations in which if it's an offence of mere negligence, for example, on the part of someone like a compliance officer or a money laundering reporting officer, that there might be some benefit to it. But equally, it's worth bearing in mind that there already exists the option of cautioning, for example. The Code for Crown Prosecutors deals in some detail with the circumstances in which it may be appropriate not to prosecute someone at all. In broad terms, it says that the more serious the offence that has been committed, the more likely it is that there should be a prosecution, which actually is effectively what the code says about DPAs as well. So I wonder whether it would add anything other than a sense of public unease that probably wealthy people employed in the financial industry in particular are using it as a get out of jail free card. I can see the political fallout from its introduction probably outweighing any individual benefit or indeed benefit to the state. What's wrong with cautions? And if a caution's inappropriate, I suspect a DPA would be inappropriate as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a little bit of a red herring. There's lots of things that the US do that it would be inadvisable to replicate, and this is one of them. The criminal justice system is already set up to deal with individuals. I cannot see in any way how a DPA would be a good would be a sensible resolution for an individual. I just think that it is perhaps might be suggested a little bit of distraction to the main discussion, which I think DPA should be very much focused on the corporate element.
I mean, there's certainly.
I was just going to add. I mean, as I indicated in my talk, I think there's a case to be made for more closely aligning the sentencing options if a corporation is prosecuted with how an individual may face sentencing. I don't think it would be desirable to carry out that alignment in reverse and to try and align the position of the individual with the option of the DPA.
I mean, is there anything else from the US system that the UK system could take, do you think? It's obviously far more prevalent in America, and you've mentioned some of the numbers. Is there anything deficient about the system here that we could use, not just from America, but in other jurisdictions with similar?
Well, I think it's the opposite. I think the way that the DPA system has been set up here is that we've learned lessons from America. I mean, David mentioned in his introduction this sort of idea that a corporate sort of might be forced into a might think it has to take a DPA when perhaps the evidence doesn't necessarily support it. Firstly, I can't believe that there would be many lawyers that would advocate that approach, but I do think that, and I've certainly heard anecdotally that has happened in the US because of the way that the US DPA process is structured. At least here, certainly the role of obviously the SFO only so far, and the way they've approached it in terms of applying the code and the interest of justice test and the judicial supervision, none of those things are available in the US. And so I think, it's not that we've got disadvantages, but actually the opposite if we're going to have a DPA regime.
And judicial control as well in the UK at different levels to the US.
And I understand there's hardly any judicial oversight apart from rubber stamping in the US.
Now, Christopher, could I ask you this? Should, in your view, a participant in the process have to cooperate right from the very start? Or is there a sliding scale, do you think?
There's definitely a sliding scale, and I think this has been demonstrated by the way the DPAs have played out over the last couple of years, and I'd be interested to hear Alex's views on this as well, because I mean, originally it was that David Green was touring the city saying you had to be absolute cooperation, otherwise you wouldn't get a DPA, and slowly but surely that's been chipped away at. And there's nothing wrong with that, as I said in my opening remarks. Pragmatism is key. It's a deferred prosecution agreement. Parties can come to any agreement they want. They shouldn't be bound necessarily by the fact that you have to cooperate at the start. I mean, obviously there are some cases where really uncooperative companies are never going to be offered a DPA, and presumably that company has made a strategic decision already that they want to fight back robustly. But for others, may take longer to come to the table. They may want to establish the facts. They may want to do a little bit more work, but that certainly shouldn't preclude them from having a DPA at the end of the day.
Alex, Jane, Christopher said he'd be interested in your view.
Certainly, I think within the system and the DPA code, there is that flexibility. And it's notable that in terms of appointing monitors as well as the flexibility within the fines and the level of discount to properly take into account what level of cooperation there has been. I think cooperation remains a fundamental factor to getting a DPA, and it's important. It's a key feature of DPAs. But we have seen the recent appointment of a reviewer in the G4S case. So where there's say not a self-report initially, there are those mechanisms within the process to ensure enhanced oversight of the company as well as the flexibility on fines. I know the House of Lords Select Committee recommended more of a discount akin to the US system, which has a matrix system where there is and isn't a self-report, and said that was something that should be looked at. So that kind of comes back to your question as well on the US system as an interesting point.
Well, thank you. And lastly, before we invite Sarah and David back into the room, so to speak, and I think this may dovetail with the next Law Commission webinar as well. And I'll just put this generally out there. Is the criminal Crown Court the right forum for the DPA process, particularly now looking at the backlogs of tens of thousands of cases arising from the pandemic? Is it right that airtime is given in the criminal courts to the corporate process, or in your view, do you think it should be removed and put squarely into the civil process?
That's, if I kick off on that, Andrew, I mean, I think that in practical terms, the backlog is unlikely to be greatly increased by the occasional DPA, and usually, of course, the DPAs are dealt with by a High Court judge or indeed a Lord Justice of Appeal being parachuted in to deal with it, rather than tying up ordinary Crown Court business. I think, given that it is a deferred prosecution, it's conceptually difficult to imagine it being dealt with other than by the court, which ultimately may have to deal with the prosecution. That's my view.
I think there'd have to be an acceptance that it was genuinely a quasi civil slash criminal matter for it to fall outside of the criminal court purview. I'm sure corporate clients would very much like the whole process to be moved outside of the corporate or outside of the criminal courts. But I think there has to be a realism that it does still reflect, as Alex says, the prospect of a prosecution. And are the civil courts really the right fora for that issue to be determined? I expect ultimately we'd be on a hiding to nothing if we push that agenda.
Yeah. Christopher, Alex, Jane. Is there anything you want to add in relation to that? Because then I think we'll bring Sarah and David back in on that issue initially.
I was just going to say briefly the importance of the implications for individuals and the fair trials. And in the recent Amec Foster Wheeler judgment in particular, that was emphasised at the outset, as well as the application of the sentencing guidelines in calculating penalty makes, from my point of view, a Crown Court matter.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, Sarah, David, I know you're going to have a webinar pretty much all on its own about this particular subject, but what's your view as to the criminal arena being the right arena for this process?
Well, it's certainly an interesting question, and it's tied to one of the points that I think, I can't remember if it was Michael or Christopher made, that if we're looking at expanding corporate criminal liability into sort of failure to prevent offences, then some people might say, well, those are criminal offences. Some people might say that, well, failing to prevent someone else committing a criminal offence is sort of moving away from what we might classically understand as a criminal offence, and there might be more scope for that taking place within the civil sphere. One thing that I found interesting in looking into this area is the extent to which some crimes are already dealt with, some parts in the criminal courts and some parts in the civil courts. I think I mentioned last week questions of insider dealing or price fixing in relation to corporations are dealt with in the civil courts, but individuals in the criminal courts. But I suppose the bottom line is we're in the privileged position that we're ultimately presenting an options paper to the government at the end of the year. So we've got the possibility of presenting a number of options and making the arguments for and against them. And it may be that within those options, we can include options to expand the criminal scope corporate criminal liability, but also potentially some alternatives to that. But as you say, Andrew, this wider question of what is the role of the civil courts in questions of corporate malfeasance that amounts to criminality is going to be the subject of next week's webinar, and I would advise everyone to tune in and not miss it. 7 days today, 14th of July, with Eversheds Sutherland. I'm sorry, Sarah, was there anything that I jumped in on that one?
No, absolutely, that's fine. I was just going to say what a perfect segue that was into next week's seminar, so that was ideally set up. Thank you, everybody.
Well, thank you. Sarah and David from the Law Commission, and can I thank our four panellists. I hope that you have found it interesting and worthwhile, and thank you very much for joining us. And as Sarah and David have said, next week, the next part of the Law Commission, please do attend if you possibly can. But otherwise, a big thank you from all of us, and take care and stay safe and well.
Thanks to you. Thanks all. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you to our listeners. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode. As you will have heard, the Law Commission are hosting another webinar this Wednesday, the 14th of July. To find out more, please visit their website. Join us next week, where we'll return to our usual podcast format, where we'll have members of 7BR discuss recent judgments and other legal topics of interest. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.